This is The Last Word, Conversations with Writers. I'm producer and host Abigail Adler. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR Radio in Santa Fe, New Mexico, every Wednesday at 4 o'clock. We also stream live on the internet at ksfr.org, and be sure to check out our podcasts on our website, ksfr.org, under the Programs tab, drop down to the podcast, and click on The Last Word. Today we're talking with Sally Bingham. Hello, Sally.
Hello.
Lovely to have you here.
Thank you.
Sally is a writer, a feminist activist, and a philanthropist. Sally's first novel was published by Houghton Mifflin several years after she graduated from college. It was followed by four collections of short stories. She has also published six additional novels, three collections of poetry, numerous plays produced off-Broadway and regionally, and the well-known family memoir Passion and Prejudice. Her latest, most recent book was published in 2014, The Blue Box, Three Lives and Letters About Her Mother, Grandmother, and Great-Grandmother. Sally was the book editor for the Courier Journal in Louisville, Kentucky, and has been a director of the National Book Critics Circle. With part of the proceeds from the sale of her family's company, which encompassed a newspaper, radio, and television station in Kentucky, she put her fortune to work as founder of the Kentucky Foundation for Women, a nonprofit that makes grants to women artists, and the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture at Duke University, which is creating an extensive archive, actively collecting papers for women who work for social justice. Sally's lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico for 25 years.
Long time.
I'm happy to have you here with us.
Thank you.
It sounds like many of your works, and certainly the memoirs, are about women's lives and the choices that they face.
Absolutely. When I started out writing and publishing, women were submerged in terms of most literary fiction and nonfiction. That's different today, but there's still very interesting and mysterious aspects of women's lives that we still don't hear very much about. I would say primarily the issues involving women and work.
What do you mean mysterious?
Well, because they're not discussed and not written about very much. I suppose it would be more logical to say submerged rather than mysterious.
Well, and many of you are from Kentucky, a southern state, so your mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, your ancestors are from the South. And women had a particularly maybe subdued position in the South, or
yes,
unrecognized. Anyway.
Well, it was paradoxical. You may remember hearing years ago that a Southern lady was only supposed to be in the newspaper three times, at her birth, at her marriage, and at her death, which gives you an idea of how quiet they were supposed to be. But in terms of my maternal ancestresses and many others, they were quiet officially, but they played a very big role in their families, not much outside of their families, except for my great-grandmother, whose most active life involved being one of the originators of what was then the Richmond Women's Club. A lot of the early activists found their home in these women's clubs. We think of them now as being largely social, which they were, but they also gave women who had no other access a more public role to play.
And she also lived through the Civil War.
And she lived through the Civil War, which she looked at through rose-colored glasses. Her memoir is amazing in that way. She was living in Richmond, which was the capital of the Confederacy, within sound of the guns at some of the great battles. And yet her view of the war was that somehow it was kind of wonderful. Her father turned their house in Richmond into a military hospital. But her memory of that as an 11-year-old girl was that these soldiers were just so delightful, and she would go and sit on their beds and play with her dolls, and never seemed to strike her that a lot of them didn't really recover. A lot of them, of course, would have had limbs amputated. But that's very familiar to me from growing up in the South, that one of the obligations that women in the old days, and even to some extent now, assumed was that they gave a bright glow to everything that happened.
Mm. And you're very fortunate in that you've got actual written material.
Absolutely.
From three generations of women. So you come by this in by way, to some extent, of hereditary.
Yes.
Talent.
All this material was literally in a blue box that was in the top of my mother's closet when she died. And my sister, who was charged with cleaning out the house, asked me if I felt there was something interesting in this box, and I thought there probably certainly was. So that's how the book came about.
Well, you also talk about this is a written record of these women's lives, but you're very conscious of social issues and class issues at that time and now. So women who were writing at that time were basically educated and white in the South.
Absolutely. In fact, certainly these women in my family were, although my mother was the first person in her family to graduate from college. So it wasn't across the board, but they were all white privileged women, and I'm talking about privilege not in terms of money, but in terms of their sense of who they were. They often educated themselves in the family library, which would have been put together by a father or grandfather and include all the classics, so that they grew up reading Shakespeare and reading the Greeks and reading 19th century poetry and absorbing a lot of those ideas and that language.
Well, that's one of the ways, it sounds, perhaps, that they navigated a basically patriarchal society.
Yes, they did, by using the tools of the patriarchy, because that's what those libraries were. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's sometimes a very successful way to go, because you're not perceived as being a rebel or an outsider, but you may actually have some fairly unusual ideas.
And these women did.
And they did, in that they believed in their own sense of importance. Oh. Now, that cuts both ways, as we know.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they had some blinders on,
obviously,
as far as society around them.
Yes. My great-grandmother, living in Richmond, they had slaves, but she always referred to them as servants. That was the polite way to talk about slaves. And the implication was that they were really members of the family. I'm sure those African Americans did not really think they were members of the family.
Mm. How did that perspective, coming from, I assume you knew maybe your grandmother a bit and your mother, how did that perspective influence your life and turn you into a feminist?
Well, I saw that I was really raised by the black women who worked for my family. And, of course, they were not being compensated adequately. I was very aware of that. And they had very little status, almost no time off. And it began to seem to me very interesting that women, to me, who were the most potent figures in my white family, were so low on the totem pole. And that had to do, of course, not only with them being women, but with them being black. So I began very early to put these things together, that the white people, the white men, who seemed so important in the eyes of the world, were not really the ones who were doing the basic work of raising children and keeping a house running. So the contrast was what really made me begin to think, I want to talk and write and learn about the power that women have.
Right. And these women, you talk about how they were indulged. They had a lot of indulgence, but they also had a lot of self-discipline. It wasn't every
Yes.
woman that sat down and wrote
memoirs. No, although it was a letter-writing time, and most women, most white women certainly, were writing letters all through this period, which spans 1831 to 1932 when my parents married. Mm. No longer true. As we know, letter-writing has almost entirely disappeared.
And it sounds like they saved a lot of that.
Yes, they did, which again is an example of their sense of their own value. You know, that these letters were not just something to be thrown away, but were worth keeping. And I think it would be fair to say they knew that they had a part to play in history.
Well, and it sounds like they were living in a time and in a society where they were certain in some ways of their position.
Yes, yes. And that raises a really interesting issue, because since their sense of importance depended on a very rigid class structure and an enormous acceptance of racism, can we have a sense of importance without that? Because, of course, that's where we have to go.
So where did you start your activism that came out of this experience?
I started it as a teenage girl, although unconsciously, when we were required to do volunteer work during the summer And I think it was my first job was working in what was the women's insane asylum, as it was called then. And I had such a strong sense of these women who had been closed away probably for life were not what I would call insane. They were different. And why were different women closed away? Huh. So that was, even though I was too young to know what to do with that experience, that's really, I date my feminism from that period when I was about 14.
That sounds rather scary.
It was very scary.
For a 14-year-old girl.
It was very scary. My mother, one of her many admirable qualities was she exposed her five children to all kinds of things that nobody would dream of exposing children to now. And I'm very grateful to her for that because it pricked the bubble of privilege.
I want to take a quick break here to let people know that you're listening to The Last Word, Conversations with Writers. I'm Abigail Adler, and today we are speaking with Sally Bingham, feminist activist, philanthropist, and writer. And her most recent book is The Blue Box, Three Lives and Letters. It's about her mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, and her life growing up in Louisville, Kentucky. Writing. When did you know you were a writer?
I think I knew it when I was in first grade. My family was very theatrical and in who they were and how they presented themselves, but also in their love of theater. And I began very early with my first grade classmates to write and force them to act in plays. I don't know what they really thought about that, but I didn't much care. It was just what I wanted to do. And I went on from that when I was a little bit older to produce, direct, and rewrite Shakespeare so that my classmates in my little girls' school could put on a summer production of a Shakespeare play. And it usually lasted about 45 minutes, so you can see I did a lot of cutting. I didn't see any need for those plays to be so long.
Right. And then you went on and wrote more plays, some
yes.
of which were actually produced
yes,
off Broadway.
Yes, they were, yeah.
And what kind of issues were you tackling in plays that maybe you couldn't tackle in books?
Well, it's interesting. My plays are much funnier. Maybe that's because I was depending on other voices to speak these funny lines. But I think what I really learned from playwriting is how to entertain. And I'm not sure I had known that before. I was working in the theater all during the 80s when I was living in New York. And I really understood how wonderful it is to hear an audience laugh. And that opened up the whole possibility of being a serious writer who is also entertaining. Because as we know, we have to be entertaining.
Right. It reminds me of that classic movie Sullivan's Travels, about a writer who doesn't want to write comedy.
Yes.
It's not serious enough.
It's not serious enough.
Until he realizes how important it is.
Yes.
So how did you, from writing plays in high school, how did you get your first book published right out of college?
Well, I was in the right place at the right time. I didn't know it then, but I was at Radcliffe, which was the girls' part of Harvard, which put me in the Ivy League chute, where you learn about people and people learn about you sooner than they would if you were in a college town somewhere in the Midwest. I also had won some very prestigious prizes as an undergraduate because I was writing and publishing in the literary magazine at Harvard, the Harvard Advocate, and I was the first girl, in quotes, to win the Dana Reed Award for the best undergraduate writing.
Oh.
Never had been won by a girl before. And then I won a guest editorship to Mademoiselle, which at that time was really the beginning of a lot of literary careers for women, including Sylvia Plath. Most people know that she was a guest editor at Mademoiselle.
That was quite a coup. Mademoiselle
yeah, it really
was not just a fashion magazine.
They actually had a literary editor. I was her assistant that summer in New York. And that's, of course, something we can't even imagine now.
Right. And writing for the literary magazine at Harvard, am I correct that I think E.E. Cummings and
yes,
John Dos Passos and
yes.
all those people
all
before
the big dogs.
You
yeah.
Were part of that.
Yeah, they were. So it had a bigger reputation than a lot of college literary magazines would have.
And how do you, you're now in Santa Fe, and it seems that you're writing full time, which
yes.
is quite challenging? Do you get to go to coffee shops and sit in the corner and,
no.
and look very scholarly?
All I do in coffee shops is look at people. One of the wonderful things of being my age, I just turned 80, is that people don't look at me anymore, which is a huge relief because as a writer, you need to be able to study people. And if they're looking at you, you're not going to be able to look at them for very long. So I'm a great people watcher. I adore it. It's one of the best things about Santa Fe is that there's such good people watching here. But for my actual writing, I need to be entirely alone because otherwise the outside world is just has too much effect on me.
Well, how do you deal with that? Again, you are, in a way, what you were saying about the women before you, doing a lot of things that are basically solitary.
Yes, they are. They're solitary. I'm fortunate enough to have a studio. I've never been able to work at home. And my studio is somewhere where nobody goes except me and my dog. And that's where I have the kind of solitude that I need to write. Now, many women never have that luxury. Right. They have to write on the corner of the kitchen table or something like that. I guess if I had to do that, I would have learned how to do that. Mm-hmm. But it's extremely challenging because we're so responsible. Mm. And sensitive and responsive. And so whatever is going on around us, I think, is likely to interfere with the creative act.
So you think for women especially, if at all possible, to find a corner they can shut them off themselves?
Absolutely.
I've heard of women who've turned like closets into a little
even
writing
a closet.
Nook.
You know, Virginia's had a room of her own. Well, not everybody has a room of her own, but you can maybe find a closet. It's something rather discouraging about that a serious writer would have to work in a closet.
Well, you have to start somewhere,
right? You have to start somewhere, that's right.
So you've finished a novel that's going to be published in another year or so.
This is not
a novel, I'm sorry, a biography.
It's a biography, right? Of Doris Duke. Uh-huh. It's called, the title is Doris Duke, The Invention of the New Woman. It's going to be published in the fall of 2018 by Farrar, Straus & Giroux in New York. It's been a six-year labor, quite a labor. Doris Duke left all of her papers to Duke University, which was founded by her father, and she was a very important supporter of that university. So I would have been interested in this story because at that time there was no representation of Doris Duke on the campus, and I didn't understand why her father and her uncles and her brother were all, not her brother, her nephew were all represented there, but Doris Duke was not. So that interested me, and then when the archive became available, my friends there said, well, here it all is. Here's what she left from her life.
Can you explain why she was someone who interested you?
Because she seemed to have been erased. Mm-hmm. I mean, even today, some people know about the foundation she started, the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation. But even though she only died in 1993, which isn't that long ago, she's really not remembered at all.
Were there other things she did besides start the foundation?
Oh,
that
yes.
You bring out?
Many others. She was an extremely independent woman. And at a time in the first part of the 20th century when that was not really acceptable. And she used the fortune she had inherited from her father to establish three really amazing what have become public museums, one in Newport, Rhode Island called Rough Point, which is a museum of the Gilded Age. It's the house that her father actually lived in. One in Somerville, New Jersey, is called Duke Farms. It's 2,200 acres in suburban New Jersey, which is now a big conservation project, as her will mandated. And the most important, the house she built outside of Honolulu, which is now the Center for Islamic Studies, because she, on her honeymoon traveling in the Middle East, became fascinated by the arts of Islam. Long before anybody in this country, except for a few individuals, had any interest in that particular form of art. And her huge collection now lives in the Islamic Center in outside of Honolulu. And that place also sponsors all kinds of workshops. Mm. So it's a real gluing together of the two disparate parts of the world, which is extremely unusual, even today.
She must have had a very unusual mind.
Yes, she did.
And you're also writing a memoir
yes,
about your brother.
About my little brother who died in 1964. It's called Little Brother, and the subtitle is The Short Life and Strange Death of Jonathan Worth Bingham. I finished the first draft based on the little that remains from his life, because I've always been deeply saddened and puzzled by what happened to him.
Are you? Can you fill in? Is it, in a sense, a personal memoir for you also?
Yes, it is, because I was his big sister. So in the traditional way, I had a lot of responsibility for him and for what happened to him. So it's an attempt to make peace after all these years with the tragedy of his early death.
Mm. So you write, that is your main activity now? You write every day?
Yes, I write every day.
And how do you do that?
Well, I get up in the morning very early. Mm-hmm. I do some yoga, which I believe in, and some meditation, trying to gain a few minutes of peace and quiet inside my head, because I live alone. And then my dog Pip and I go and take a good hike, and then by about 9 o'clock I'm at my desk. I write my first drafts by hand. I'm a big believer in handwriting.
And why is that?
Because the use of the cursive opens up a part of the brain that the keypad just doesn't touch. I believe in ink pens, real ink pens.
Oh, are they cartridge pens or
no? They're real
bottle.
Fountain pens.
Oh.
And they make a huge mess. I'm usually covered with ink. Today I seem to be pretty free of it, but it makes a huge mess, and there's no really good paper anymore, so you have to just use the yellow lined paper. But at least that's the way I do it.
Okay. Well, thank you. We have a moment left. Can you tell us, do you have a website?
Yes, I do. It's www.sallybingham.com, and Sally is spelled S-A-L-L-I-E. I post on it twice a week, usually.
Oh, okay. And what about your books? Where can people find your books?
Well, right now, you would certainly go to Garcia Street Books, and you'd go to Collected Works. You can also order the Blue Box directly from my publisher, Sarah Band Books. Or, of course, if you have to use Amazon, you can use Amazon. I try not to do that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Sally Bingham, for being with us today.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in to The Last Word, a weekly conversation with writers about writing and life. If you missed any part of the show or you want to hear it again, check out our podcasts at ksfr.org. I want to thank Sean Conlon for engineering the show. I'm Abigail Adler, and this is The Last Word. Thank you.